Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, the CJ McCollum Show, where every week New Orleans Pelicans star CJ McCollum discusses names and storylines in and around the NBA with inside perspective you can only get from someone in the locker room and on the floor. That's the CJ McCollum Show. Listen where you are listening to this podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. This is the time of week where we have a guest join us, and I'm thrilled to have our guest with us now, author of roughly 375 books, and most recently, the director of Say Hey, Willie Mays. It's a new documentary that HBO has on Willie Mays. His name is Nelson George. Nelson, what's going on?
Hey, man. Pleasure to be here.
Now, man, I tell people, and this is really the truth, and I'm going to have fun with this because I think I'm going to work in some stuff from your work that you might not have seen coming in a sports interview. But I read your book, Hip Hop America, in the summer of 2000. And that was one of the things that inspired me to be like, hey, I think writing about music is something that I might want to do. And then there that gets us to here. And so it's interesting now to see you kind of tap dance a little bit into what becomes my world, which is sports, with the Willie Mays doc. And I guess the first question is, what made you want to take on this project?
Well, I knew the people from on both sides. LeBron's camp, Spring Hill. I tried to sell a couple of projects with them. So I got to know their team, Jamal Henderson. On the other side, the company name company, Colin Hanks and Shane Stewart, I'd done a show called Tales from the Tour Bus, which was this
crazy. This is one of my favorites.
Documentary slash animated series. So they came together and they said to me, we're talking with Willie about trying to do this doc. Are you interested? I grew up in New York and I saw Willie on TV. I saw the Giants were a very big influence in Brooklyn because they were the first team to have so many Latin ball players. So on the schoolyards of Brooklyn, everyone tried to pitch like Juan Marichal as a leg kick. A bunch of brothers were trying to stretch like Stretch McCovey. And obviously everyone took a shot at the basket catch. So he was part of the sports world that we, even if we didn't see Willie play a lot. And then when he came to the Mets in 72, I was about 13, I think. And the way the New York media embraced him was, I had never seen that kind of love for any black athlete at that time. Even Dick Young, who was a notorious hard-ass columnist at the Daily News, loved Willie Mays. So he's been a part of the texture of my sports life since I was a kid.
All right. So one, I want to tell people on Tales from the Tour Bus, even if you don't get to check it all out, just go check out the one about Bootsy Collins, James Brown, and acid. Like that's the one that everybody needs to get a hold of. If you have not, shout out to you and Texas own Mike Judge on that series. Now,
two words, yellow sunshine.
Yes. Now, the Brooklyn part, I was going to ask you about because you were born about, I guess, 4 or 5 years after the Giants and the Dodgers left New York. But I was wondering how the Giants part tied in, like Brooklyn, obviously, with the Brooklyn Dodgers. Yeah. It was their city. So it's interesting for me to hear when you talk about the connection with the Latin players, because that is a big thing with the Giants, that the Giants went brown and black in a way that most of baseball had not. The Dodgers obviously had in their way, but the Giants added the Latin component to that. And so I hadn't thought about them after leaving New York, still having a tie to New York as a result of that.
Well, you know, here's the thing. My father was a Harlem dude. So he's from Virginia. That whole diaspora came up in 56. I was born in 57. And the Polo Grounds was still, you know, still stood when he got here. And a lot of those guys, that Harlem world that we kind of talk about Willie being part of was still there, which is the Red Rooster, Small's Paradise, Wilt Small Paradise. There were still echoes of Sugar Ray's spot on 7th Avenue. So Willie, and Willie kept coming back. It wasn't like when he initially left. His wife is from Harlem. So he was still around when my father came here in that generation. So the Giants were still a presence, and Willie was still someone that people talked about. So the Giants, it's interesting because the mythology of Jackie and the Dodgers is so powerful that people forget the Giants were a big team here. At one point, you know, they played in a huge ballpark. They played basically, technically it's not Harlem, but maybe a block or two away. So they definitely still had a resonance when I was coming up and when my father was coming up. So there was a lot of conversation about the Giants. And it was still guys who, you know, wore the Giants hats and stuff like that. Though once the Mets came, that, you know, that obviously disappeared.
Yeah. Now, I found it interesting that you say that LeBron and Spring Hill approached you to do this, because one thing that I have wondered, like even before this doc came out, I've been thinking about what is the significance of Willie Mays in the current zeitgeist? Because so much of media had come out of New York. And so the superstars of New York, and especially the baseball superstars of New York, were outside. So even me, I am 42. In my age range, you get like Willie Mays as a guest star on My Two Dads, and you don't have to explain who he is, because Willie Mays, after having won a World Series in New York and being a product of New York, was such a big star, even going to San Francisco. And so I'm hearing you say that Spring Hill came to you and not vice versa was interesting, because I honestly was a little bit surprised that guys that are younger than me would still understand and appreciate what the resonance of is Willie Mays as not just sports superstar, but also American icon, because I don't know if it's possible now for younger people to appreciate what a big deal a baseball player was at that point.
Yeah. The aura, like everyone seemed to catch. That's like part of the highlight reel of America. Willie's kind of aura is still there. Even in this time where baseball is not the primary sport. And, you know, to contextualize Willie, you know, before Ali, right, Willie is the biggest black athlete and arguably the biggest athlete in America. He's bigger than Russell. He's bigger than Chamberlain, who played basketball, which at that point are still kind of minority sports. He's bigger than Jim Brown. Probably, you know, maybe Sugar Ray was probably maybe equivalent in boxing. So Willie's, and, you know, the point you make is that Willie, not only played in New York, he played on both coasts. So he has a following on the West Coast. He plays the Dodgers like, you know, 10 times a year. He's in LA a lot. He was on the Donna Reed show, which was a show that no one remembers now, but was a big TV show in the mid 60s. He's on Bewitched. He's a regular on the Ed Sullivan show when we only had three networks. We don't have a black sitcom with Diane Carroll until maybe the late 60s. I think what year Julia came on. Willie's on these shows in 1965. 66, the middle of the civil rights movement. The way to look at Willie, and I think why he resonates, is that he's a peer of Sidney Poitier. He's a peer of Sammy Davis Jr., who during the early 60s, when Dr. King and the marching's happening, they are in their own way normalizing black excellence. These are guys, Sammy gets in, he's with Frank Sinatra. He's in people's homes. He's doing on telethons. Obviously, Sidney Poitier is, you know, huge movie star. Willie's on national TV consistently, either with, you know, Game of the Week or whatever. So he was a prevalent and accepted black man at a time when that was still a new idea. You know, and of course, like those two guys, like Sidney and Sammy, Willie, when the Black Power movement came in, Willie took it on the chin as well, because as Harry Edwards says so well in the doc, you know, we were rejecting our fathers to go to that next place. But you had to have that generation like Willie, Ernie Banks, Hank Aaron, Bob Gibson, guys who came out of the Negro Leagues, still playing in the 60s, who had to take a certain attitude, a Jackie Robinson attitude of shut up and play ball, that the next generation rejected, but you couldn't reject. You had to have them to have something to reject. Someone had to be the person who went through those doors.
Yeah. Like, I do want in sometimes, like I remember a comedian named Teddy Carpenter who had a joke. Sure. People talk about slavery. He would be like, man, if I was a slave, if you was a slave, you'd be picking cotton. Right. Yeah. Like, yeah. Willie Mays was not getting off the bus in Birmingham from Birmingham and showing up in 1951 and being like, well, let me tell you what this is about to be. Nah, it was not going to be that. Like, you think about with Jackie Robinson, And I think HBO doc on Jackie Robinson pointed this out, and it's one of the more stunning things that as much as we give credit to the Dodgers and Branch Rickey for their progressiveness, when they did their retirement celebration for Pee Wee Reese, they rolled out the stars and bars for him because he was from Kentucky, which I would note, not a Confederate state. Right. But this was still the state of baseball, even for Jackie Robinson, even into the mid to late 1950s, right? Oh, we're not just talking about the 1940s. Like, I think that the next generation, you're right, they had to push back against their fathers because they had to be there. But there's no way that those guys could have kicked it like that in the 1950s and even gotten to where we were in the 1960s.
I think one thing I didn't realize is that we always talk about Jackie in the major leagues. But for Willie, he was the first black player in his league, minor league team. And and that's true. Like my man, Bill Greason, who's in the doc, who was in the Black Barons with Willie, he ended up in the Cardinals system. He was one of the first black players in the Cardinals system. Piper Davis, who was Willie's manager at the Birmingham, was one of the first black players in the Red Sox system. So while Jackie was here, there was all these other people going through catching hell all over America in small towns from like 47 really into the 50s. So that whole idea about everyone just going to spout off and raise the black fist, that wasn't happening then. I mean, it was interesting too. Another little detail is that those teams tried to bring in at least two black players at a time or four.
So they could stay in the same room.
Yes. So they had no odd numbers. Because you know, so that was they all went through this kind of system of, you know, we have to have this many and can only have this many at a time. I think it's interesting. One interesting story: the shortstop on the Black Barons team, named Artie Wilson, he then got signed to the Giants. He was one of the black players on the Giants when Willie was being considered to be brought up, and basically Artie, who played with Willie and was, you know, older, said, I want to go back. I want to get out. I'd rather go play in Oakland than be in New York in the Giants, because he felt like if I went to Oakland, it's a blacker town. I can have more freedom. He basically, you know, offered to give up his spot in the majors, also because he just felt the pressure of being in New York. And you know, Willie, when he first got there, is well documented. He didn't start well. To go from 19 years old in Birmingham, Alabama, you spend 1 year in Trenton, you spend a year in Minneapolis, more or less, and then you're in New York City. That's a lot. And you know, Willie was not super. He wasn't well educated. He went to one of those A&T schools, which meant he was being trained to be a cleaners. You know, I mean, that's the reality of education in Alabama for black people in the 40s. Jackie, when he came in, Jackie was about 28. He'd been in the Army. He's a UCLA graduate. So it's hard to make that comparison because Jackie was a super worldly, sophisticated man compared to Willie. And that was one thing I think that when we talked to Willie, he was very aware of the sort of educational disparity between him and Jackie. So he was very respectful of him. And, you know, as we sort of document in the film, Jackie clapped at him a few times in the 60s for not being active enough. Willie would never spoke back until maybe 68. And that was only because Jackie made a comment, or I think it's an article, I forget now, where he not only attacked Willie for not being active enough, but also Jim Ray Hart and one other young black player. And Willie, as his want, his thing was to defend these guys as much as defend himself. And all the time that we researched and we read every book that we could find and all, Willie almost never spoke explicitly, you know, about race, almost in any context. It was always in a sense of, you know, brotherhood and community. He never bought into being an activist in the way that Ali made popular.
Yeah, and, you know, and the activist as athlete thing is always interesting to me because the truth is, I don't know if Willie Mays would have anything to say that I actually wanted to hear, right? Like the idea that we want people to talk. Now, we want them to say what we want to say no matter what. Very few of us are so dedicated to the nobility of discourse that we just like, no, man, just get something out here so we can have some ideas. Like nobody told O.J. Simpson that, right?
Yes.
But I think that Willie certainly, and I think it's an important distinction to make between him and Jesse Owens would be an example. Like OJ, of course, is like the far extension of it. Right. But where Jesse Owens got in trouble, I don't recall Willie Mays telling everybody to sit down and calm down like Jesse Owens did in 68 when he kind of lost everybody. And so I always wonder what it's like for guys like that who make the call like, no, this is probably not the way that I should go about this. Right. Like, this is probably not my bag. But you're Willie Mays. If it was your bag, it would be such a big deal. And therefore, it almost feels like a loss.
Yeah, I think that so he gets a lot of, you know, we interviewed his son, Michael, and Barry Bonds, obviously, about it. The person who really had the best perspective was Harry Edwards. Harry was, as people may know, Harry helped is a great theoretician of black activism at San Jose State. He was an integral part of the 68 Olympic boycott. Still advises Kaepernick on some of his moves. And Harry really broke it down for us that, you know, that generation of Willie was the access generation. They were the people who had to open up the doors, had to take the verbal and other blows. They opened a door for that next group, which is, you know, the Ali, you know, Ali, Russell, Jim Brown, Alcindor, then Alcindor, now Kareem, and that famous press conference photo of, you know, these guys, you know, there for, you know, the Olympic boycott. But then, the pendulum swings back again. If you look at the Jordan Magic generation, Jordan has more in common with Willie than he does with Ali. Black excellence, I don't really speak on politics. The difference, of course, is that Jordan is able to monetize his crossover appeal in a way that wasn't possible for Willie in the 60s. But, Jordan followed that same playbook to a great degree. And that's a playbook that actually Jackie Robinson laid out in the 40s of putting it on the field, making black excellence and making people come to you. You know, just the difference, of course, again, is the NBA was so much smarter about how marketing talent than a way that Major League Baseball probably still hasn't been. So it's a pendulum. You know, it's a pendulum. So we shouldn't, as I think one of our interview subjects, Todd Boy, says, you got to judge Willie as Willie Mays. If you're making an argument that he comparing him to guys from different eras, you don't understand the era he came up in.
It's only a kick, a jump, a block, it's only a serve, it's only a tackle, a run, it's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I think the richness of this story, there were so many angles that I could imagine for you, like having to leave on the floor probably hurt. Like, for example, my dad, who is 85 years old now, so he's of this generation, he views Willie Mays very much in the context of Mickey Mantle and not in a way that I would say is complimentary of Mickey Mantle. Not that he did not think that Mickey Mantle was a good baseball player, but Mickey Mantle was... They're right next to each other. There's just one little difference. There's just one, right? And they stand as comparative figures. Like, that's a big part of it. And I also thought that there was an interesting subtext and something that comes up in your work at other points, which is Willie Mays is kind of representative of the Great Migration.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. But I want to get to so Mickey Mantle thread is one of the threads that did make the final film. They both came up in 51. They played in New York, played against each other in the World Series. One of the things about their relationship, number one, they were good friends. Number two, which got lost in trying to cut the film down, was they used to call each other when they were negotiating their contracts.
Really?
Yeah. and talk about what they got offered, because they both were vying for the most. Who's the, you know, when Willie signed, I'm going to forget the, when Willie signed his contract in the early 60s, I think at one point he got $100,000, which was then the highest paid baseball player. And I think at one point it went up to 120, 110. And these numbers seem very small now, but they were huge back in the early 60s. Unprecedented numbers, really. So they were compatriots in that. And ultimately, you know, they both ended up both getting suspended from baseball for a time for working for casinos in their post-playing careers. That was a whole thread that just ended up, you know, it kind of ended up getting put to the side when we got Barry to do an interview, quite honestly. Yeah. Because that, to talk about something that happened then, we can get Barry Bonds to talk about Willie Mays. That just took up all that real estate in the dock. But here's the thing you got to know about Willie versus Mickey. Mickey Mantle hung out at Toot Shores. He liked to drink. He hung out with Billy Martin and Whitey Ford, is well documented. Willie Mays does not drink. Willie Mays does not smoke. In 1951, Willie Mays entered the major leagues with a 32-inch waist. In 1973, when he retired from baseball, he left baseball with a 32-inch waist. The brother took care of his instrument.
Yeah, that is, I love, like, when looking at all of that and looking at those times, and it really is incredible to stop and think that even if we're just talking about for 7 years, those two guys play in the same position in the same city at the same time and basically living parallel existences. When you think about it, part of what drove Mantle to drink was the fear of leaving this small town in Oklahoma and being in New York City. And it's interesting that Willie went kind of in the opposite direction on that. Well,
he had Harlem embrace Willie. I mean, I'd heard a little bit about the original Red Rooster. And as I started researching it, he was a regular in there. They had a table for him in the back. They also looked out for him. They didn't let certain people get next to him. It's funny because Mickey was living on the Grand Concourse, walking distance from Yankee Stadium. Willie was living literally, I mean, we went to the building. It's two blocks from the Polo Grounds. So I think that in many ways, Willie being in Harlem and being in a community that valued this young black ball player and knew the significance of him being there, I think that helped Willie a lot. And I don't think Mickey had the same kind of support system.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting overlap here to me, like when I think about with migration in particular, right? Because one thing, when people talk about black participation in baseball, one thing I typically point to is we're ignoring that we have become a more urbanized population. And baseball fields are not necessarily the easiest to find, though New York City is a little interesting. You get up to 171st Street, there are baseball fields, and our Hermanos are out there playing a whole lot of baseball, right? Yes. Like that part kind of gets lost. But I was one of the scenes in the doc where Willie is riding through Harlem and you see all these kids and he's playing stickball with them. And I just thought about what a comfort it must have been for some of those people making that migration where baseball was still there when they got there, right? Like baseball was a thing where they were. And then they get to what is now the mecca of baseball. And now you have the best player possibly in the major leagues. And it's Willie Mays and he lives right up the street.
Yeah, I mean, that's so important, man. I mean, Willie, I didn't realize that kids in the South play stickball too. Coming from New York, he talks about they called it a broom ball.
Yeah.
Baseball for black folks, the Negro Leagues were a vital part of the community. As Faye Davis, who was Piper Davis's daughter, says in the film, every Sunday there'd be a doubleheader. People got dressed up. It was a big deal. So when people made the move to New York, Philadelphia, Detroit, Chicago, they brought that love with them. And, you know, the Hank Aarons in Milwaukee, you know, Ernie Banks in Chicago. They gave comfort to black folks who'd grown up in a southern rural environment. I mean, the baseball field, I know from my experience growing up in New York, going to Yankee Stadium the first time when I was a kid and looking at all that green grass, I've never forgotten that feeling of being in a ballpark and this immaculately taken care of environment. And I can only imagine how it felt for my father's generation to be able to go someplace that still feels like that familiar in this crazy environment that's so different. My family's from Newport News, Virginia. about as far away from the Bronx as you can get. So baseball was a connective thing for so many people.
And when I think about like that time in New York, like I think it's something that can be hard to understand. Like I've lived here for 5 years and I got a little bit better grasp of it. Right. So I live in Harlem. People to a degree can either A, be very surprised to see me walking up and down the street, or this is a thing, right? People like me live in the neighborhood and you might see us, you know, you might just see us walking around there. In the New York of that time, where if you're Willie Mays, you're not living in whatever the equivalent of Tribeca was then, right? You're not living in whatever the equivalent of Soho was then. You're living where Black people live.
Yep.
And you are a dude in the neighborhood. Like you might just be Willie Mays, but you're still like a dude in the neighborhood. Like I think about all the jazz musicians living out in Queens, for example. They're the dudes in the neighborhood who then influence the hip hoppers because these are the cats, like these are the people that you just grew up around.
Absolutely.
Like how wild it had to be in the 1950s if you just got off the bus and you're like, hey, wait, what do you mean Willie Mays lives right over there?
Well, I'll tell you, so like that Seventh Avenue thing, that was one of my favorite sequences in the movie. We have a section we built around a Duke Ellington, Ella Fitzgerald song about Harlem. That strip on Seventh Avenue next to Stryver's Row, Wilt hung out there all the time. Wilt and Willie knew each other. Sugar Ray knew each other. They golfed together. Like, but they would meet on Seventh Avenue at 130 whatever street, by the Y. That connectivity, as you said, to the community is why it's so funny, because we think about the game now, we think about how disconnect or different, even though they're digitally connected, that LeBron and Dwayne Wade are divisible, but they're not touchable. Willie was touchable. The Red Rooster, Jackie Robinson hung out at the Red Rooster because it was a spot that you felt comfortable and you were taken care of. You could still go, those guys could kind of go downtown, right? But not, they're not going to be loved up there. I mean, Willie met his first, and I think he met his second wife, both in Harlem. So, you know, that sense of like, you're hanging out, there's women around, there's music. And from where Willie lived on St. Nicholas Place to the Red Rooster, it's a 5 minute drive. And if he decided to walk after a game, it's probably a 20-minute walk. And guys would just get out the ballpark, take a shower, and walk over and hang out. So that to me was kind of amazing, that Harlem and probably the whatever Harlem it was in the south side of Chicago, these guys were part of that. And as you say, these clubs were full of jazz musicians. There's so many stories of jazz musicians and new ball players and vice versa. Sammy and Willie were really good friends. Whenever Sammy played the Bay Area, he went and had food at Willie's house. One thing to say about Willie, just in terms of the distinct community. So in New York, he was younger and he hung out a lot more. He got to SF, especially after his wife and him divorced in 62. He got a beautiful place as kind of his bachelor pad, and he became more of a home buddy. You know, when I talked to Cepeda and I talked to Marichal and Tito Fuentes, who played with him, he didn't go out very much. If they were on the road, he was the first. He was the first guy in the shower. He wouldn't even wait for the team bus. He would get a taxi, go back to the hotel, set up a card table in his room, have some food brought in, have some non-alcoholic beverages brought in, and that was his world. I wouldn't say he lived a monk-like existence. That would be, but his sense of taking care of his body and taking himself was very apparent in all the conversations. He would invite people. Bob Gibson came over to his house when they were, you know, after Bob had thrown at him twice at the game, he'd invite Bob over to the house. Joe Morgan was a regular visitor. Any of the Black players who came to San Francisco, Willie might not go with them out to the Fairmont Hotel, but they came to his place and they hung out, played pool. So he very much was a connector and a mentor. And I think that one of the things that I really wanted to get at in the doc was this idea of mentorship. When I first interviewed Willie, he kept using the phrase, take care of. He said, you know, Piper Davis took care of me. When I got to New York, Leo DeRocher took care of me. But by the time we get to San Francisco, I took care of Orlando. I took care of Juan. I took care of Bobby Bonds. And eventually that same thread connects him to Barry. So there's a strong sense of baseball as a community and passing on mentorship or even giving, you know, items away. He was famous for giving away golf clubs, giving away clothes to players, you know, because guys weren't making that much money back then. There's a great story that Dusty Baker tells, you know, about him first meeting Willie, liking Willie's glove. Willie gives him his glove. That was very, very typical. Tons of stories of that. So I think that same sense of coming from a place, Birmingham, Alabama, where there wasn't a lot of resources and people shared a lot. I think he felt the same thing in Harlem where he was taken care of. And that was a big part. That's still a big part of his character.
Barry Bonds has a significant role in this documentary. First of all, Barry Bonds damn well have sat for this documentary because he sat for Johnny Gill's Unsung on TV One. So, like, if he just turns up just out of nowhere, you're just sitting there, and it's Barry Bonds' friend, rub you the right way. Like, it's just,
dude, you won't believe this. I ran into Johnny Gill this summer at some, like, R&B event. Mm-hmm. And he said, what are you working on? I said, you know, the Willie Mae. He said, oh, you talked to Barry yet? I'm like, what?
It is still one of the great shocks in my life. Barry Bonds and Johnny Gill are apparently the homies.
Who yeah. Knew? That Johnny Gill knew something. That Johnny Gill knew baseball.
Yes. Yes. But it's an interesting thread, obviously, because Barry Bonds, not quite the Willie Mays of his generation, because it's just the difference between playing left field and center field.
Yeah.
But if you believe Willie Mays to be the best ball player of his generation, there is no question that Barry Bonds is the best ball player of his generation, probably the best ball player since World War II. And they had this connection through the mentorship with Bobby Bonds that gets us to Barry Bonds. Now, what I found to be interesting about the way Willie deals with him, and I guess it's a function of proximity in the relationships, his attitude about Barry Bonds given the performance-enhancing drug talk is much different than, say, yeah, Hank Aaron. Yeah. And I noticed in the documentary, you had your positioning with Mays and Bonds, but no discussion of the other stuff. Was that a conscious decision?
Yeah, I mean, we met Barry at Willie's 90th birthday. You even see the footage in there where he's with Willie when Willie's cutting his cake. We spoke to him briefly about it. He's interested in doing it. But I think it took a year, over a year, to finally get him in the chair. And the bottom line is he's suspicious of media. I don't know specifically, but I feel like he agreed to do some interview at some point and he got blindsided by, you know, questions about steroids. And so he's very gun shy. We had to really convince him. And I got to say the Giants team, Larry Bear and their team, they really wanted him in this because they knew that that's part of the legacy of the franchise. You got to have Barry talk about Willie. So it took a while to get him down. And when we got there, it was nothing like anybody expected. The brother was relaxed. He was vulnerable. He was humble and, you know, and as much as he could be, he's a great player. But his emotion and his feelings of love for Willie were so powerful. So it was an amazing, you know, conversation. And I think, you know, you're a sports writer, so I don't know if this will change everyone's opinion, but I think it does give a dimension to this man that I think has been lacking. And, you know, maybe it's his fault. Maybe he should have been more open. But certainly it feels like everyone who's seen the film so far says, this is not the Barry Bonds that I'm used to seeing.
Yeah, the irony of it is, and I picked this up from Jeff Perlman's bio of Bonds called Love Me, Hate Me, which is a good book I recommend people check out, is Bond said that he learned from Willie, right, that the superstar has to be distant, that the superstar cannot be perfectly accessible in those ways. And I think that Barry, in a lot of ways, went a wee bit too hard. The other thing that I think becomes interesting is Bobby Bonds is his daddy, not Willie Mays, and Bobby Bonds and Willie Mays are different men. And I always imagine if the relationship between Barry and Willie Mays also has to do from the fact that, quite honestly, Willie Mays was a gentler man than his father was. And when you have that kind of father, having that kind of godfather is a helpful and important thing.
He said at one point, because we did a long interview with him, this was one bite, that we had it in, but we couldn't finally squeeze it in. He said that Willie was the good angel and his father was the tough angel. And so Bobby constantly critiqued. Willie constantly lifted up.
Right.
And he said, I needed the tough angel to get to try and get as good as the good angel. Yeah, he told some crazy stories, man. Like his father would give him, they would break rocks. He would get a sledgehammer and break rocks because Bobby felt it would make your hand stronger and, you know, just toughen you up. I was like, wow. I mean, you know, that's some you know, hardcore stuff. So definitely Willie was the comforter, the bolsterer, which is consistent with Willie's attitude to everyone that he really cared about. Yeah, man, it's you know, I say this is maybe, I love Field of Dreams. And I was one of those guys crying in the, you know, in the theater because my father never played catch with me. So I was bawling when that scene comes out. And in a strange way for me, I always felt like this film in some ways, it's the plot is the Willie Mays story. But in some level, it's also Black Field of Dreams because it's about these mentorship things. Willie's father sees his boy when he's 4 years old, thinks he has potential, has him playing with men in this, you know, the steel mill till teams when he's 11, 12. He's passed on to Piper Davis, who's a legend of Black baseball in Birmingham. He's in a room full of, he's 15, 16 in a room full of grown-ass men in Birmingham learning the game and so on, where Willie himself then becomes that mentor figure for so many others. So that relationship between Willie, Bobby, and Barry is fascinating. And I think it's also just from a Black male perspective to see the love and the ways in which these guys manifest that love for each other, you know, where Bobby's hardcore and really exists, but to make this kid be the best he can be. I think that was, to me, it's very powerful. And as we were doing the film, so a lot of the other threads, like the Mickey Mantle thread, they fell to the wayside for me because I felt like this was some real emotional and I think not seen enough stuff.
Yeah.
You know?
Now there's another level that I think you explored that is very important, that it may on its face seem simple, but I really think it's a big deal, which is spelling out what a great athlete Willie Mays was. Like, forget about baseball player, just strictly as an athlete. Like, even if we're talking about just the shots of him with his shirt off, because, you know, you hear people talk about the older players as being like plumbers in basketball and stuff like that. And you look at Willie Mays and you see those shoulders, and this dude got a six pack in 1961. Yeah.
He's a phenomenal athlete. One of the things that really was wild when you look at especially some of that black and white footage of him, that man was fast as hell. I thought it was when he goes to steal a base, when he goes from first to third, his speed is insane. It looks like it's been sped up. One of the funniest things is, you know, the discussion of Willie's hands. At the end of the film, there's a little bit of like B-roll stuff of me putting my, you know, shaking Willie's hands or trying to. That's part of a long ongoing thing with Willie. Willie's hands are massive. He loves to get young guys to shake his hand because I don't care who they are, they're not hanging with Willie Mays. In the film, you see me shaking his hand. That's the second time I'm going in because he's already squeezed it. I've got to prove to him that I can hang. And so I put my hand back in and he goes, oh, you're trying now. The first time we met Willie, September 25th, 2019, we go in to get the blessing. We go to the Giants ballpark. My producer's the first one in the room. He shakes Willie's hand first. Willie goes, was that a handshake? So he's very aware, even at 90 years old, of his physical power. His forearms at 90 are as big as ham hocks. So I can, and when you see that footage of him I think it's one thing that you're hitting on something that a lot of people talk about, when you see him in 1950 something with his shirt off, that looks like a guy who works out right now. That's not a plumber.
Right.
That's an elite athlete. You know, and it's interesting, in high school, he played a few games on the football team with the quarterback, of course. Was outstanding. He played a little bit of basketball, and I found some old clippings from the local black newspaper in Alabama where, you know, he had like 23 points or something in this game. He could have been a quarterback, but there were no black people in the SEC. The only real option when he was in high school was the Trotters. So baseball was a calculated. One thing he says a few times is baseball was a sport I could play a long time. And, you know, again, talking about his physicality, in the 1960s, guys didn't play till their 40s. Guy, I think he retired at 43. His just presence, he wasn't a big man, you know, in terms of height, but the respect he got and the level of athletic greatness. I mean, anybody who's ever seen the basket catch, it seems simple. Anybody try and do the basket catch? Even if you throw the ball up with yourself and try and catch it, it's difficult. Trying to hit a batted ball that has speed on it at your waist, it's nearly impossible for most people. To do it for years, to create something that basically is I don't know, who's the last guy who even attempted that?
I've never seen anybody actually try it in a real game, other than Willie Mays. And see, I thought it was very helpful to me that the film did a breakdown of the catch of the ball Big Wirtz hit in 1954. One, for the context that gets lost, which is the 1954 then Cleveland Indians were maybe the best team ever to not win a World Series. Definitely up until that point. But I think the part that gets lost is that fence is 480 feet away. Like, this isn't turning around and getting to the 400 sign. Yes. This is a whole nother ball game of what it was. And so the athleticism of that catch, I don't think is something that really translates from the old film if you don't have all the context. So
you have to understand the Polo Grounds was a massive building.
Yeah.
And the fact that ball was even that far out was a
that would he hit it a mile. Like that, he'll never hit a ball that far again in his life, or he probably never did.
Yeah. And the fact that he did it over his shoulder, and that Willie to this day thinks that's not his best catch. I think one of the things that we couldn't – Vince, we had the late Vin Scully. We have, you know, one of his last interviews. Vin is convinced that the greatest catch Willie made was at Ebbets Field. Just we couldn't – we couldn't dramatize it. There's no footage. At some point in that early 50s, line drive up the gap. The Ebbets Field was small, and they didn't have a dirt – warning track. It was made out of kind of gravel. He says Willie went horizontal, caught the ball in midair, land, slides across the gravel into the wall. And that Jackie Robinson and Leo DeRocher run out to look to see if he caught the ball. And Vin Scully, who's seen more baseball than maybe anybody, you know, the late Vin Scully, says that's the greatest catch he ever saw. Better than the Polo Grounds. You know, Barry Bonds, who was at that game with Bobby Tolan, hit the ball up the gap in Candlestick Park. I remember watching that game on Game of the Week as a kid. That Willie leaps up, he leaps over Bobby Bonds. He kind of flies in, crashes into the wire fence, gets kicked in the stomach by Bobby, comes back and still holds on to the ball. That's the greatest catch I've ever seen. So the athleticism, I think, is very, very important, because you're right. There's this whole narrative that these guys weren't really real athletes, or not the same as today. And there's no doubt about it that Willie Mays would have been a star in several sports and definitely still be a dominant player today.
All right. The last thing I'm going to ask you, because this was the most delightful thing I found out about the Dot. How much did you light up like a teenager? First time you heard Willie Mays just sitting there cussing like an old black man.
Loved it. was so happy. Let me tell you something. That was, and that's, so I think, as I said, you know, it began kind of, he's feeling me out. Soon as I realized I got to talk to this man like I'm talking to my uncle from Virginia. Once that happened, and I started testing him, like, so let me say, are you the greatest ball player of all time? I know he's going to hate that question. But then he amps up, you know, and the more I did stuff like that, the more loose it got. There's also a funny bit. I don't know if you noticed it. He's toward the end, in the sort of after credit, he has a wad of money in his hand. Did you notice that?
I did not.
So look, and he has a big wad of money. So Willie Mays had been on quarantine for a year. He hadn't been outside. The brother still had a wad of cash in his pocket. He pulls out the wad of cash and says, you guys hungry? He said, what up, Mr. Mays? I like Jack in the Box. He pulls out $100 bill off the fat knot and gives it to his assistant. And she's like, I don't know if I can take $100 bill to Jack in the Box. And then he asked us, you know, how many guys you got? So I said, okay, we got 10. No one, I had 5. And he goes, you ain't got five. You ain't got 10 people. And eventually he did order Jack in the Box.
See, the old man move normally is to give you a $10 bill thinking you could go to Jack in the Box like it's 1974 and feed the whole family off of this. No, Willie Mays knows inflation.
Willie got a big knot. And, you know, that's, to me, that reminds me of a million barbershops that I've been in as a boy.
Yeah.
The guy, because brothers, they didn't really care about that wallet. They had a money, or they had a money clip. Something about having that money in your hand is very comforting.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is Nelson George. Check out Say Hey, Willie Mays. When's the premiere on HBO?
November 8th.
November 8th. Please check it out. I found it to be a fantastic documentary. Look forward to everybody checking it out. My man, I greatly appreciate you.
Thank you, man.
No problem. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. Thanks for watching us on YouTube. Dan Stancic and Adi Khan handling everything behind the scenes. Thank you, gentlemen. Remember, follow The Right Time. Rate us. Review us. Give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or follow on the ESPN app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.